Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we look back at the career of Michael Madigan, the longest-serving legislative leader in the country. His tenure came to an end this week. Madigan built a reputation as a master strategist, but what led to his fellow Democrats deciding it was time for a change? Getting the COVID-19 vaccine out to more people won't be easy. We hear about plans from one hospital system in Illinois and efforts to get more African Americans to take the shots. And when it comes to remote learning, there are plenty of challenges. A big one is keeping kids engaged when interacting on video. This young girl even tried to fool her teacher by placing a doll on camera.
I, like, put it at an angle where you can only see the brown hair, so it looked like my head.
So you really were trying to get away with something.
I need a break.
That and more this hour. Stay with us for Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, we'll hear about efforts to get some black individuals to take the COVID-19 vaccine. Many farmers see hemp as a cash crop, but after legalization, how are things working out? And while there have been some problems with remote learning, it has given parents a better view of how their students behave, or not, in class. That and more coming up on Statewide. There is a new speaker of the Illinois House. Representative Chris Welch, a Democrat from the Cook County community of Hillside, was sworn in this week. That was after a battle that saw several names come up as possible successors to longtime Speaker Michael Madigan. Welch made history as the first black speaker of the Illinois House, and he served in that chamber for 8 years, but he's got a long way to go to match his predecessor. Madigan has been in the House for more than 50 years and was first elected speaker in 1983, serving in that role for all but 2 years since. Well, today, we look back at his career and what happened this week. Dave McKinney covers government and politics for WBEZ, and he joins me. Dave, thanks for being with me.
Yeah, thanks, Sean.
So let's talk about, first of all, what led to Madigan being basically defeated. He could not get enough votes to be the House Speaker. He tried and tried and ran right up until what was pretty close to a deadline for a new speaker to take over. There was a scandal that had been out there for months involving Commonwealth Edison. Madigan has not been charged with any wrongdoing, but this still led to his downfall, didn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it was a big factor. I mean, this had been a steady kind of drip, drip, drip effect since last summer. That's when the $200 million deferred prosecution agreement between the government and Commonwealth Edison became public. And in that 38-page document, Madigan was referred to 72 times as public official A. And since that point, there have been two rounds of indictments, including the most recent one that involved the company's former president and CEO, Ann Promajori. But more significantly for Madigan, it included the company's former lobbyist and former legislator, Michael McLean, a longtime friend of the speakers. They served together in the Illinois House in the early 70s, and so they knew each other for a long time. And so, you know, this thing just kept creeping closer and closer to him. But I think the other thing to keep in mind that doesn't get talked about probably a lot is that, you know, members were definitely aware that the results in November were pretty lackluster. This is a situation, the election, you know, even just a few weeks ahead of that, I think there was an expectation that House Democrats were in a position to pick up maybe 10 seats. I mean, I know Republicans were deeply worried that President Trump's unpopularity in the suburbs was just going to lead to a washout. And instead, Republicans picked up a seat. And of course, the Democrats lost the retention battle for former Chief Justice Tom Kilbride on the Supreme Court, and Governor Pritzker's graduated income tax went down. So these were all defeats that really, some of them got put at Madigan's doorstep. You know, Senator Durbin, he was one of the first ones to kind of do that. So, you know, it was a combination of those things. And then the last thing I'll mention is that Madigan, you know, really began to develop serious problems with women in his caucus. And that relates back to the Elena Hampton situation and the sexual harassment problems that afflicted Madigan's political organization. All of those things came together and really kind of just worked to make this guy who was always known as the most powerful politician in Illinois really unable to just get votes when it counted.
So despite all of these things hanging over his head, Madigan still wanted to retain the title of speaker. And going into the legislative session, which just wrapped up this week, a so-called lame duck session, and a new General Assembly was sworn in on Wednesday, going into that period, there was still question if he could pull this thing out. A lot of people had said, or at least several had said, they were not going to back him. He did not appear to have enough support, but he had not bowed out yet of the race. That took until, I guess it was Monday, when he said he was suspending his campaign, not giving up, but suspending. And that was really the moment he was done for.
Well, yeah, I mean, it definitely tilted things in a way that very few people, I think, were ready to accept. I mean, because I know that probably for certainly months, I don't know how long, you know, whenever we sit down at the typewriter and tap out, you know, House Speaker on the keyboard, we're going to be automatically typing Michael Madigan because we've done it so long. But yeah, and I think that statement that you mentioned him putting out on Monday, you know, really put a different dynamic on this and made clear that it was an invitation really for others in the caucus to come forward and try to get to 60 votes. The thing I will say, though, about that statement, though, that really was a bit confusing was the very first sentence was, this is not a withdrawal. You know, he was emphasizing that he was not out of it entirely. And so I think, you know, even some of his own members, you know, Monday, Tuesday, were still thinking, well, he's still out there lurking and might put something together. But in the end, it did not develop that way.
It was sort of an unceremonious end for him. I mean, I think that through the years, Dave, reporters, political observers, others have always looked at what will it be like when he finally gives up. You know, it's gone on for so long, and some people thought he would never give it up unless something happened to him health-wise. That was not the case here. A little surprised at how it came to an end?
I mean, a little surprised I was because, you know, people who have strung together, you know, really kind of a legendary career like this, you would think would really want to go out on their own terms. They wouldn't want to suffer a defeat and have that kind of be the way some people would remember them. And of course, with Madigan, the you know, there are just countless stories about, you know, different laws and bills that he was involved in. And he was such a personality. I don't think he's going to be remembered all that long for this, but unceremonious is a very good way to describe this because, you know, the Commonwealth Edison corruption case, while he's not been charged, it does put a taint on his legacy. And I think that's unfortunate for him. His supporters would, you know, they're slow to kind of acknowledge the effect and the claims that the government and ComEd made. You know, even Madigan, you know, strenuously over the fall was saying that, hey, that this is, you know, helping someone find a job is not illegal. And really this sort of patronage angle to the ComEd case is what, you know, that's really the heart of this, I think, that ComEd was basically trying to, you know, buy off his friends and curry influence with him that way. And it's a taint. And, you know, his mentor starting out was Richard J. Daley. And of course, Richard J. Daley left office on a stretcher, basically. I mean, he died in office. And I think that there was, I certainly thought that that's how it would go for Madigan, too, that, you know, knowing how healthy he is and meticulous about eating that apple a day and, you know, adherence to fitness and everything, that he had a lot of political life still ahead of him in spite of, you know, all of these mounting problems around him. But it's quite a turn.
When you look back at, you mentioned Mayor Richard J. Daley, a lot of people, I think there is a mixed legacy there. Some people still recall him fondly, and others look at things like patronage, machine-style politics. Do you think that's where Madigan's going to fall when it comes to how history treats him?
Well, I mean, I do think that there's going to be a very different way that, you know, history, if you're a Democrat, will look at him, and probably over time, come to appreciate that he wound up, you know, advancing some pretty important causes that are important to Democrats. I mean, the abolition of the death penalty, the legalization of gay marriage, broadened abortion rights, you know, those kinds of things. While Madigan was not a big fan of them early in his career, he came around and actually supported those things and helped advance them through the House and to a governor and into the statutes. So Democrats, I think they will look back at his effect that way. And you know, what he did in blocking a lot of Bruce Rauner's initiatives, you know, during that 4-year period. I mean, he gets credit among Democrats for a lot of that. Republicans, though, will always look at him as a villain. And you know, in some ways for Republicans, having him gone is, you know, it could pose a bit of a challenge come election time, because we've seen really in election cycles going back at least to 2012 that I know of, where they would use him front and center as kind of the villain, and it was a unifying effect for Republican voters. We hate Madigan so much, come to the polls. And now they won't have him to really kind of hold up and use as a pinata anymore. So I think, you know, history, no matter what, is going to judge Mike Madigan for his tenure, for the length of his time in office, and the way he was able to consolidate power and use it. But, you know, in the end, we still don't know what that final act is, because we don't know if this corruption case involving ComEd has reached its zenith, or if there's still more to come.
And as of now, he does remain the state party chairman for Democrats, so he still has power, and he's still a key figure among Democrats in Illinois.
He is. I mean, although I think, you know, you and I have both heard over time criticism about his stewardship of the Democratic Party of Illinois, that it really was kind of an organization more devoted toward, you know, keeping House Democrats in power, as opposed to a broader, you know, trying to get people, you know, other statewide offices or the state Senate in Democratic control. So, I mean, I think, you know, there are millions of dollars in campaign funds that he controls still that you know, that will continue to give him some influence. I mean, I know his personal fund, he's still got a lot of money in, and the Democratic Party of Illinois money fund, there's still money in there. So, I mean, he will have an effect. I mean, the term, the chairmanship expires in 2022. Whether he sticks around that entire time, it's still an open question.
We've heard through the years that the term discipline comes up when it comes to Madigan, incredibly smart political strategist. Some Democrats, there's no doubt, are probably glad to see him go. But do they face any type of concerns going into a legislature now that does not have Speaker Madigan for the first time in decades leading the way for them?
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of the traditional rules and guardrails that had been in place because of Madigan are now gone. I mean, I think, you know, the sort of the power center in the state capitol really kind of tilts now away from the House and probably toward the governor, to be frank, because, you know, he is really the highest elected Democrat in the state capitol right now. And so, you know, he's going to have some more influence. Now, the real question with Chris Welch is, will he be able to be a unifying force on his caucus in the same manner that Madigan was, you know, because Madigan was able to, you know, it never would be reported because these were one-on-one side conversations he would be having with members, but things that they needed in their districts, you know, grants for, you know, road construction or bridges or schools or whatever. He could promise things like that in exchange for votes and promise, you know, as we're heading into redistricting, promise a favorable map. I mean, those kinds of things. I mean, will Welch use the same tools? He very well might, but again, he's only been around, as you mentioned, for 8 years, and that's you know, that's hardly anything compared to Madigan's long tenure. This personality that we've had in Illinois, you think of these long, really colorful political figures over time, you know, Dan Rostenkowski, George Ryan, you know, Ed Burke, Madigan, of course. I mean, these people who just stay in power for decades, they're the most powerful Democrats, you know, of their time. And in some ways, you know, you have to pay homage to Madigan because of that staying power. And, you know, he was able to consolidate power first in the 13th Ward and fend off any challengers there and make that be a base of support. Knowing that he would never lose an election there, it made him able to just hold on to the speakership. That was a very basic thing. And then just the way he would keep himself out of public view when it mattered, and he would be out and accessible when it mattered other times. You know, I mean, it was always such a contradiction to have the title be House Speaker, but yet Michael Madigan was a guy who never really spoke much out in public. The only time that was different, I think, was during the Rauner administration, where he really had to use the bully pulpit he had as speaker to come out and voice things that needed to be said to mount an opposition to Rauner. So I think that, you know, that style of his, where he would talk when he needed to, where he would go silent other times, most of the time, actually, he really learned to work to his advantage. And you know, the public doesn't really get to understand who this guy is very much, or how he thinks, or what he thinks about just things that we're all living, you know. And so that part is always going to be kind of a unfortunate thing, because I think that, you know, in a democracy, that it's important that we know as much as we can about the people in power, you know, because we have to be educated and we have to know who these people are who are representing us. And in some ways, you know, you could always look at a roll call and know how Madigan voted, but it was hard to understand what his motivations were sometimes. And that's the part, you know, he used it to his advantage, but unfortunately for the public good, a lot of times we were kept in the dark.
That's Dave McKinney. He covers government and politics for WBEZ. Michael Madigan's career in the Illinois House has spanned 9 Illinois governors, 9 Chicago mayors, and 8 presidents. Nearly half of the current members of the Illinois House were not even born when he started. Danville officials hope this is the year their long-sought casino project gets started. A revamped lineup of investors and developers is awaiting Illinois Gaming Board approval for the new license application. That's after a 2019 application was deemed incomplete. Jim Meadows has more.
Casino resort chain Golden Nugget is loaning money and its brand name for the Danville Casino project to be built and operated by real estate developer Wilmorite Management. Wilmorite Vice President of Gaming Development James Wilmot says even though video gaming has taken a bite out of their market, he thinks a casino and restaurant in Danville would attract gamblers.
You don't get a total experience playing a quick slot at a restaurant or the lobby of a country club. Well, when you walk into our facility, you have a highly safe, securitized gaming experience that's meant for adults.
The new casino proposal has less than half the slot machines and gaming tables that were proposed by the first one. All the same, Danville Mayor Ricky Williams Jr. says the casino will create jobs and tax revenue and also help local businesses.
Because they'll supply the food that's used at the restaurants. They'll supply a lot of the equipment that's used for cleaning and things like that. So it will have a huge impact on our community.
Wilmot says if the Illinois Gaming Board approves their application this spring or summer, the Golden Nugget Danville Casino could be ready to open in late 2021 or early 22. I'm Jim Meadows.
Stick around. There is more to come on Statewide. This Statewide, I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, efforts to get those who are wary of the COVID vaccine to take the shots. But next, on January 6th, a mob of pro-Trump extremists stormed the U.S. Capitol building. Teachers watched the insurrection unfold and wondered how they're supposed to explain it to students. Peter Medlin has more on that.
Morris Elementary School principal Dave Raffel and his family stayed glued to the news until late at night. He looked over at his son, an eighth grader, processing the images and realized he was going to have to say something to his other kids, the 1,200 at his school. Every day, Raffel films his morning announcements and says the Pledge of Allegiance for his students, who are still learning remotely due to COVID-19.
Good morning. Today is Thursday, January 7th, 2021. Please join me and stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
On Thursday, he was more conscious of the words of the pledge, and for one of the few times in his career, felt he needed to send a message to his kids that everything was going to be okay.
I know many of you yesterday may have watched TV and maybe saw some things that were concerning and maybe even scary for you.
Raffel told them that violence is never how to handle their problems and quoted Mr. Rogers, quote, "When you see something scary in the news, look for the helpers."
I've always been very upfront about things. And so when something goes down, I try to just be honest with kids when I talk to them and trying to be sensitive, trying to be aware of that parents have different ways of what they want their kids exposed to, but I try to teach it as a life lesson.
Watching an assault on the Capitol is shocking, but for Nicole Frazier and other social studies teachers in her department, the pro-Trump mob was predictable.
It was overwhelming. As it's going on, part of it was just kind of like, of course this is what's happening. This is what they've been saying the whole time.
She teaches government and history at Jefferson High School in Rockford along with Lucas Clevenger.
Our first reaction as we're sitting there watching it is going to be that whole, what do we do tomorrow? Like, how are we going to bring this up? What are we going to talk about?
Clevenger was in the middle of teaching a unit about the Civil War, which provided a context to the events he could have never fathomed he'd have to discuss as a first-year teacher. He pulled up the picture of a man walking the halls of Congress holding a Confederate flag.
The kids, I think, were mostly shocked than anything that they had never even thought about it, that the Confederates never made it into D.C. with that flag, but it was able to just stroll into the building yesterday.
Lessons on the election of 1800, the first peaceful transfer of power, and the War of 1812, the last time a violent mob breached the Capitol, suddenly take on new relevance and urgency. Mikel Andrade got home from work on Wednesday and didn't think it was real.
At first, I didn't, like, believe it. I thought it was, like, some fake news or something.
He's a senior at Jefferson High School. He thinks political violence in America like this could be more common as he gets older.
To be honest, I feel like it's going to impact a lot of us young people. We're going to see, like, violence. They're going to see it more normally.
His teachers couldn't hold as much conversation about it as they'd like to, a consequence of their blended in-person and remote classes during the pandemic. Nicole Frazier's in-person U.S. history class has 5 students compared to 28 in her remote course. She used resources from the PBS NewsHour to guide her students through the events of January 6th and what the pro-Trump extremists did at the Capitol. She also stepped back and explained not only why Congress was there, but also how baseless claims of election fraud were denied in court. It also became another lesson on media literacy.
It's really important for the students to understand that when they're reading something, the language that's being chosen is being chosen for a reason. It's trying to get you to understand, or it's trying to reach a certain group of people.
Another one of their social studies colleagues dove deeper into the role of white supremacy and domestic terrorism in the day's events. Between the pandemic and the attempted siege of the center of American democracy, educators have had to figure out how to explain unprecedented events more than they ever imagined over the past year. But in 2021, in the age of social media, students are going to hear about it. And teachers want to be there to help them process what's going on and look out for the helpers. I'm Peter Medlin.
The most recent farm bill legalized hemp production nationwide, but left individual states in charge of the oversight. As the crop continues to roll out across the Midwest, some states are seeing more success than others. And as Harvest Public Media's Dana Cronin reports, farmers generally remain optimistic about hemp's future.
0.3% is hemp's magic number. That's the level of tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, that distinguishes hemp from marijuana, and one of the few things the federal government regulates. Jay Cada didn't quite make the cut.
We were the first crop in Iowa to test hot. We were more than twice the limit of THC in our plants.
He and his colleagues who run 4M Farms in southeast Iowa had no other choice.
We had to mow everything down and burn it.
Cada says growing hemp is hard work. Unlike row crops, most things have to be done by hand.
I have a newborn baby, so I spent all summer, instead of playing with her, I was weeding a field. You know, we were filthy and we were dirty and we were sweaty and it sucked and it was hot and it was miserable. And after all that, she's like, that's cool. I'm just going to light that on fire.
Cada isn't the only one. About 13% of Iowa's hemp crop came in above the legal THC threshold. In Missouri, it was about 9%. That's largely because for many states like Iowa and Missouri, this was the first year of legal hemp production.
Anytime you start something up, I think you have some highs and some lows and some things you didn't see coming at you.
Robin Prusner oversees the hemp program for Iowa's Department of Agriculture. She says there have been a whole host of challenges for farmers this year, including the amount of sheer manual labor.
That's like, you know, having a tomato garden that's 5 acres or however big compared to just your little kind of more typical garden in the backyard.
Producers across the Midwest struggled with other issues in the field this year, like pests and weeds, but it didn't get much easier once the hemp was harvested. Most hemp grown in the Midwest is for CBD, or cannabidiol, which is the non-psychoactive ingredient found in the cannabis plant. Extracting the CBD requires a processor. But because the industry is still so new, there's a severe lack of licensed processors across the region.
We have now licensed 364 hemp processors for what is, at this exact moment in time, an exact 800 licensed hemp growers.
David Lakeman manages the Division of Cannabis Regulation at the Illinois Department of Ag. He says the gap between growers and processors has narrowed slightly this year. But some more experienced farmers have figured out a workaround by acquiring their own processing licenses. Farmers like Andy Houston, who's been growing hemp in Illinois for 3 years now.
The CBD that's in our products came off of our farm. We know exactly where it's been. We know exactly how it was raised.
Because he has dual licenses, Houston can grow the hemp, extract the oil himself, and then sell different infused products on site. It's a model that's worked well for him, and along with a great growing season this year, Houston says he's optimistic about hemp's future in the state.
Oh, the hemp's going to be around. I mean, it's just, it works too good not to be around.
Not only does the product work well in terms of relieving aches and pains, Houston says hemp also loves the Midwestern climate. Not to mention, the CBD market continues to grow. David Lakeman at Illinois' Department of Ag says, look out, corn and soybeans.
I think that within the next 5 to 10 years, hemp will be, in terms of the dollar amounts, one of the top three agricultural exports of the state of Illinois.
He says hemp's medical and industrial potential, plus the ingenuity of growers, means the crop's future is bright. I'm Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
Vaccinations for COVID-19 are underway in Illinois, but not everyone is eager to take the shot. A recent virtual town hall meeting answered questions and tackled some concerns for the Black community. Yvonne Booz has more.
Making it plain what Black America needs to know about COVID-19 and vaccines was moderated by health experts, faith leaders, and several other organizations. The event was hosted by the Black Coalition Against COVID-19. Some may wonder why a conversation was needed specifically for the Black community. According to Centers for Disease Control and Prevention data, COVID-19 hospitalizes Blacks at about 4 times the rate of white non-Hispanics. Death rates are almost 3 times greater. A recent press release indicates that the average age of whites dying of COVID-19 is 81, for Blacks is 72, and Hispanics 68. The CDC recommends that individuals ages 75 or older receive the vaccine first, but with the disparity of deaths in the Black and brown communities, the Illinois Department of Public Health and Governor J.B. Pritzker have lowered that age to 65. Mark Morial is the president and CEO of the National Urban League. He says one of his main concerns is how the vaccine is distributed, but he also has other apprehensions.
There is a lot of misinformation and lack of information about the vaccine, about the process used to develop the vaccine, about the process generally used to develop medicines and therapies in the United States.
Morial says there are questions about whether the creation of the vaccine was rushed. He also suggests that some Black people aren't trusting it because of the past. He calls this the ghost of Tuskegee. The Tuskegee experiment was a syphilis study where Black men were told they were being treated for the disease, but instead they were given placebos. Many of the men passed away from the disease or suffered other complications. Some members of the Black community are questioning what's in the vaccine. Dr. Kismekia Corbett is a viral immunologist at the National Institutes of Health. She was a key player in the development of the vaccine. Corbett advises that the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are both messenger RNA vaccines. She explains that these are made up of lipid nanoparticles, which is a ball of fat wrapped around the messenger RNA.
There are no tracer devices, there are no microchips or anything of that nature that are being delivered with this vaccine.
Corbett addresses the worry that some have about how quickly the virus was developed. She suggests that the public is only seeing the last 10 or 11 months of work.
But the preclinical science that drove this vaccine development extends even beyond my tenure at the National Institutes of Health, even up to 10 to 15 years, starting in the days of the SARS coronavirus.
Dr. Anthony Fauci also joined the forum. He answered a question about the mutation of the virus and confirmed that the vaccine is still effective against it. He reiterated that Blacks continue to be disproportionately impacted by the virus, and that's why two things need to take place.
One, an adherence to the public health measures that we double down, and two,
when the vaccines become available to the particular people in the different subgroups, that you make sure you get vaccinated.
Fauci says there is light at the end of the tunnel. And as more people get vaccinated, he says we'll get closer to going back to normal. But until then, he explains, people will still need to wear a mask, keep social distancing, and wash their hands. I'm Yvonne Booz.
About 10,000 workers across more than a dozen Illinois hospitals run by OSF Healthcare have received their first dose of the coronavirus vaccine. Christine Herman checked in with OSF's Vice President of Pharmacy, Sandy Salverson, to learn how hospital systems are now working to get the vaccine out to the broader public.
In some places, we're going to the health department location because that might be a civic center, it might be a community center, and assisting with the vaccination process. And then the state is responsible for, accounting for the doses and managing the doses. And others, we're still trying to figure out what that's going to look like. It's complicated. And, you want to make sure that you can be the best steward of the doses that we get because they're not easy to come by. There's still sluggishness within the supply chain, both from Pfizer and Moderna. You just got to keep working through the process.
I understand from the Champaign-Urbana Public Health Department, they're saying that the doses they get, they're getting them out as quickly as they can. So the limiting factor, at least in Champaign County area, is the number of doses they're actually receiving from the federal government. What other factors are keeping this rollout from happening more quickly?
So there's a couple of factors. One is, the CDC or the federal government definitely decides how many doses each state gets. And then there has to be a division of doses within each community. One of the things that Illinois chose to do with the Pfizer vaccine in particular, because of the way it comes, it's only 975 dose increments. They chose to ship to all the different jurisdictions for the most part, thawed so that they could separate that out and get to a reasonable quantity that's going to meet the community's needs, albeit that, we might have received vaccine that's about 2% of our population. I mean, it's really low. And that's not much different than many of the other states. So the goal really is to get as much vaccine administered without wasting. And that's something I'm really proud OSF Healthcare has really accomplished. We have very minimal waste. I mean, we're finding arms, for the doses that we get, or we've coordinated with the various health departments in our communities to see if we can transfer it to be able to use the vaccine. And all of that requires a lot of coordination.
I wonder if you could address something that I feel like might be on people's minds. Once the vaccine is open to someone 65 and older, even within that age group, there are probably some people who need it more than others if they have certain health conditions or other risk factors, or if they're more a frontline worker versus someone who works from home. I'm curious if you could share your thoughts on how you would advise people to make the decision of when I am eligible for the vaccine. Should I rush to get it or should I let other people go first?
Sure. I liken that to the conversation I have with my parents. So my mom and dad are very different in terms of their overall health. One of them has more health conditions. And I really encourage them, like, you've got to be closer to quote unquote first in line. And she may not be first in line. Whereas that if they had to choose between the two of them, I would tell them to choose one over the other. It's one thing to do that in your immediate family group. It becomes a lot harder when you're talking about a neighborhood or a county. And so I think just sharing the facts, explaining the process as best as we can, as we continue to learn more about, how many doses that we can get will help, but it's probably not going to be perfect. And it's trying to answer all the questions as timely as we can. I do still refer a lot of people to the Illinois Department of Public Health FAQs because those are really useful and they put some context. There's not clear timelines, but it definitely helps people understand what's going on.
That's Sandy Salverson, the Vice President of Pharmacy Operations for OSF Healthcare, and she spoke with Christine Herman.
Thank you.
There's still more ahead on Statewide. And a reminder, you can find links to our stories. Just go to statewideshow.com. Stay with us. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Jessica Ramos led efforts to produce a report from the education advocacy group Advance Illinois. That report was based on focus groups, including 120 students, parents, and caregivers, and they came up with recommendations on how the state should handle recovery from the pandemic. Maureen McKinney spoke with her about the effort.
The problems from COVID-19 for students and families, what were the most severe?
When we first went into this idea of doing focus groups across the state, we wanted to really just understand how education was going. And as we were preparing our questions and the direction that we wanted to go in, I quickly realized that we couldn't just focus on the educational experiences of students. We needed to focus on what students and families were experiencing overall before even asking about how education was going and how they were experiencing schooling and their engagement with, you know, this disruption that's happened to their learning. We first started with questions about their experiences overall with COVID. And in that one area, we realized that communities are really struggling with accessing childcare. And that has trickled down into how students are engaging with their education, how parents are supporting their children. So we heard stories from parents that are, you know, both identify as essential workers, where they are finding themselves with no access to childcare because childcare providers are either not in business or have made a difficult decision not to take their children because they're putting themselves at a higher risk. You know, we heard stories from, you know, one parent where one parent is a firefighter, the other parent works in a hospital, and the childcare provider made a choice not to bring them in because of that high risk. In other situations, childcare just wasn't available in their communities, and parents were finding themselves having to take their children to work in order to make sure that they were learning. We heard stories about how parents were getting phone calls from their teachers saying, you know, your child isn't engaging today. Where are you? Where is he? Where is she? And, you know, it's harder to control that when you're not with your child at the time. And then when we started to ask them how they were feeling overall, we learned very quickly that there are a lot of challenges that children and, you know, students are experiencing as it relates to their social, emotional, and mental wellness. Students are feeling very isolated and disconnected from their peers, from other educators, you know, especially our students that are engaging with schooling remotely. In many situations, our students express that they haven't seen any of their classmates since the start of the school year, because when they tune into their Google Meets or their class meetings, it's a shadow box that they see, as opposed to, you know, the videos that we see in Zoom meetings when people choose to turn their videos on. And that comes back to some decisions that school districts have made in order to ensure equity, where they don't require students to turn their videos on. Teachers haven't met their students all year, and they have to imagine what their students might look like given that reality. And then on the academic front, we're seeing some inequities in the rigor of the coursework that students are engaging in. The reality is that as much as we would like to hope, engaging in class remotely is very different, especially in a world where our educators were asked to pivot with no choice, right? Because we're living through a pandemic, but to pivot to remote learning and to a different structure of learning as well, even in person, because we have to ensure safety of the students as this is all happening. And so the educational experiences of our students have drastically changed, and it's been a major adjustment for them and our educators alike.
In terms of recommendations and what to do, did some of those stand out as more important?
Absolutely. you know, one of the main issues that we saw was the impact that resource inequity is having on our students and our families across the state. And as we think about the recommendations moving forward, we think it's extremely important to ensure that we're on a path towards ensuring that our school districts and our communities have the resources they need to support students. We know that this pandemic has not impacted students equally because there was inequities in our system that had existed even prior to this pandemic. This has only been exacerbating that. And so as we think about the path to recovery, we need to make sure that we invest in the resources needed, that with those resources, we target some of those supports to ensure that students are supported socially and emotionally, and that we are closing those gaps in access.
What were some examples of the inequities? I imagine the disparity in access to technology.
Yes, absolutely. Well, that was one of the issues that we saw. In some situations, we heard stories about some students having to ask a family member to drive them to a local church, a local restaurant that had Wi-Fi access in order for them to be able to work on their remote learning. We heard stories about, you know, the funding disparities. The reality is that, you know, even the remote learning setting is felt differently by different students in different areas of our state, depending on the infrastructures that were in place before that. And that all comes back to resource equity and funding equity that we, you know, as an organization, highly, highly value and prioritize in our work. And, you know, we saw the benefits of the investment of, you know, the evidence-based funding formula because some districts were able to pivot almost immediately, provide every student with the laptop, provide students with the supports that were needed. And some districts, despite best efforts, are still struggling to connect with students. Due to the broadband access and the inequity around that. And then another one of the inequities that we heard, the inequitable access to rigorous and engaging coursework. We heard stories from students, you know, both from the end of students that are participating in AP coursework and IB coursework, and then students that are participating in coursework in a way that is just and what we would consider like quote unquote regular classes. And that experience was very different. Students in the AP side felt like they hadn't experienced too much disruption. They had a course map that they had to follow because there was a test at the end of the year that they have to take, you know, in order to get that coursework for college. And in our classes and our students that participated that were in regular classes, you know, we had an example of one student share that they were in a Spanish class remotely where they hadn't even spoken Spanish yet because they're not able to engage in that dialogue that they would if they were in person.
The report talked a little about what is getting lost in learning because of the COVID situation. Is there a way or ways that schools can do their jobs once COVID-19 subsides and we get back to normal?
One of the most important things that will be required as part of the recovery and the rebuilding from this is that we need to ensure that there is state guidance and support in thinking about how school districts navigate the time that comes after this. The reality is that we have over 850 districts in our state. And if we work on 850 solutions, then we are going to continue to see inequities play out. We are going to continue to see, you know, the impacts of students follow us into the long term in the way that students are able to persist and continue towards college or a post-secondary, you know, option that they choose. And if we don't, you know, provide some statewide guidance and statewide support in the form of resources and infrastructure to ensure that these impacts are minimized, I think that the story for us can look very different. We know that our students, you know, as I mentioned, are not feeling this impact equally. All across the state, you know, we are seeing stories where some children are benefiting from participating in pods, and some students are going to school in person, and there are some that have been attending remote school from the very beginning, and households look very different across the state. Some parents have the access to support their students and the ability to do that, and some don't. And we cannot put that blame on our parents, but, you know, as we think about the recovery, we need to think about how we as a state have a role in ensuring that our students are supported and that our families are supported through the process of recovery and rebuilding.
That's Jessica Ramos. A link to that report about teaching during the pandemic and what should happen next is at our website, statewideshow.com. Well, many parents have been getting a rare peek at how their kids behave or don't in class. Families have experienced challenges with remote learning, but a few have experienced some unexpected fun. Susie Ahn has some of their stories.
This is my first grade son's remote music class. He's putting on quite a performance lip-syncing instead of singing along.
You're just like moving your mouth. Why do you do that?
Because I don't like the song, Anna, so she thinks I'm singing.
Why, what happens if, like, she sees that you're not singing?
Maybe I'll hurt her feelings or get in trouble.
My son Augie and I have clashed often this semester. He doesn't like remote learning, and I have what teachers call poor classroom management. But I've had fun seeing him learn in real time and his creative ways of slacking off. Some parents say these small moments have brought them a bit of joy in a difficult year. Like Sophia Kim, who says sometimes her labor goes unrecognized by her two elementary-age sons.
You call me in because you need me to stand next to you while you take your test.
9-year-old Brian is hot and cold when it comes to his mom helping with school. One day, Kim made a comment in passing that she'd like to have grandchildren someday. Brian responded,
children are too much work for me.
Yeah, have you been seeing how much work your mom has been putting into all of this?
Yes, and I don't want that to become me. I want to, like, probably have some, I want more me time.
Brian says this opinion isn't a reflection of his own behavior. Rather, it's based on how annoying his little brother is.
I have to
You have to shh.
Mom Laura Davis is wrangling her daughter Harper and son Harrison while managing a hoarse voice.
What is her name again?
Miss Susie.
Miss Susie, I'm 5.
And Harper, how old are you?
3. 3. And that's Daddy, and he is 15.
Daddy is not 15.
Davis's daughter, Harper, has a lot of hot takes, and she learned fast how to use the unmute button in her preschool class.
So Harper unmutes herself and goes, hi, I'm Harper Michelle Davis, and this is boring. And I went, oh my gosh, you can't say that. Yeah, why did you have to tell her?
Because it was too boring and I wanted to tell the truth.
High five, Harper.
Out of the mouth of babes. Davis says it's a little embarrassing, but she can't help but laugh. She's enjoyed seeing how her kids learn, like her son writing his name for the first time, and her daughter starting to draw recognizable images, like a house. Fourth grader Kate Altenberg is over remote learning.
Boys misuse the chat and, like, people don't know how Google Classroom works.
Mom, Bridget Altenberg, says Kate's been pretty independent, but one day she got a note from the teacher.
How did she put it? She said you were not a great online customer, which I thought was a weird phrase.
It seems Kate tried to pull a switcheroo by having a doll stand in for her.
I, like, put it at an angle where you can only see the brown hair, so it looked like my head.
So you really were trying to get away with something.
I need a break.
You needed a break?
Bridget and Kate both got COVID-19 early on. Altenberg thinks her family is fortunate to have recovered and that she and her wife still have jobs that allow them to be at home with Kate.
I would never say I'm grateful for this time because there's so many other people that are really struggling. It has been fun to have her around and to overhear the comments in school and kind of see how the teachers are handling it.
She's grateful for how families and schools have come together to try to make this year work.
Susie Ahn with that report. And that's it for this episode of Statewide. We'll be back next time and have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find this week's show and past shows at our website, statewideshow.com, and also like us on Facebook. Just look for Statewide Show. We're glad to be with you each week, and be sure to drop us a line. Let us know what you think. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.